As we sit here on this Friday, it is 52 days till Election Day, a long haul, I know. But hey, look on the bright side. The Fed meets next week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 16th of September. Good to have you here, as it always is. Everybody's sad, isn't it, that I get excited about a Fed meeting? Such is my life. All right, moving on. This should, could, might be the week that we put the financial crisis in the rearview mirror, at least for households in this country and their incomes. We start our weekly wrap on this Friday with the news from the Census Bureau of that 5% jump in median household incomes last year over 2014. Here to help us figure things out, we've got Neela Richardson from Redfin, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. They are in our studios in Washington, District of Columbia. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, this was, it was basically unvarnished good news, this report from the Census Bureau. My question is, why were we all caught so by surprise? Because I certainly was, and it seemed like most other people were as well.
Right. 2015 was a great year. Yeah. How many times, Kai, on the show have I been talking about income growth and lack of it?
I know.
And we finally got it.
And we got it. And it was
great news, and we were surprised. But, you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves, because we're still not even back to where we were in 2007. Household incomes are still about 2% lower. But even given that, yep, it was a widespread increase in incomes across a lot of demographics, working class, yep, middle class, of all races. And so we did get this groundswell of income growth, and we should be happy about that, but cautious about its sustainability.
Exactly, and we are. But Sudeep, the thing I want to point out is that for all the broad-based nature of the gains that Neela was talking about, and they were, it was not geographically equal. And my question to you as a Washington reporter is, how does this play into the election and where things are going to go?
It certainly changes a little bit of the debate that we've had. The one word we've used so much over the last decade, at least the last 5 years, was stagnation. And this was a big jolt to suggest maybe we're not destined for stagnation. Maybe we actually do have the ability to generate much stronger gains and get out of the funk that we were in. So that's a good sign. There was a split between rural and urban folks. There, we obviously have more people in cities, so that it's not the worst thing in the world. And there were some quite a bit of variation within what you would call rural as well. So you have to there are some factors there you have to think about. But it does fit into the fact that we have not seen enough gains. And no matter what you think of this 1 year, we have not seen a strong enough pickup in incomes overall, or in the poverty rate, even though that's far better than it was, or in the insured rate for health insurance, even though that's far better than it was. And so there's so much more room there of what we would have hoped to see by now, that is really what this election is about. Have we improved as much as we should have improved?
Right. Very quick pass through the mind of Janet Yellen. The Fed meets next week. Is a rate increase on the table, Neela, do you think?
You know, there's evidence with the recent inflation news that things are growing today, right? But that of the 175 things in the basket of that defines inflation, two are the outstanding ones, health care and housing costs. I don't think that's enough of a jolt to really move the needle on whether the Fed raises interest rates next week.
Yeah, Sudeep, real quick on the Fed.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. All right. Well, I'm with you. I think that's probably true. All right. Meeting at the White House today, the president had a bunch of TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership people in to talk about that trade deal. He had John Kasich. He had Henry Paulson in, making that push for the lame duck thing. Sudeep, the president wants it, but is it going to happen?
You look at the television, and it was a bizarre parallel universe. Like, what program is going on here where the Ohio governor,
the Republican,
an election season, a Republican is at the podium trying to support the Democratic president on a trade deal? It just does not compute. And to have the people who got up there, and even earlier in the week, to have CEOs come from around the country and push on the same issue, to push support for TPP, you have to think, do you realize what's going on around the country right now? Now, what people are saying about trade, they can get together and try to lobby lawmakers, but these are the lawmakers who are in their districts for the next 2 months, worried about whether they're going to be elected or be swept away from something that they don't even really understand.
Neela?
you have to go outside of Washington, D.C. these days to get bipartisan consensus. And that's what the president tried to do. It's not going to sway too many people in that chamber, though.
Neela Richardson at Redfin, Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal from our bureau in Washington. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend. Wall Street this week has been up, down, and all the way around down. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We touched a bit on the politics of this week in the American economy, Sudeep, Neela, and I did, but there was a bunch more of it to talk about. Secretary Clinton gave a speech about health care in part. Donald Trump, setting aside for a minute his event this morning, gave a speech about his economic platform in which he promised, among other things, to basically double the growth rate of the American economy and create tens of millions of new jobs. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains how that might work.
Right now, our economy is growing at about 2% a year. Donald Trump says he would rev up growth to as much as 4% a year. And he says that would create as many as 25 million new jobs over the next decade.
It'll be very hard to get to 25 million jobs.
Prominent Republican economist Douglas Holtz Aiken says he agrees with Trump's goal of faster economic growth. But he says Trump's numbers, they don't add up.
So the only way to actually create and fill 25 million jobs would be to have more immigration, and that doesn't appear to be on his in his sweet spot.
Holtz Aiken says there just aren't enough people in the U.S. to fill 25 million jobs. The last time there were was when the huge baby boom generation was in its prime working years, back in the 90s. Now they're reaching retirement age. Labor economist Stephen Rose worked in President Bill Clinton's Labor Department. He says the boomer generation is passing through our economy like a pig through a python.
There certainly is demographic factors, though, and especially the baby boomers or the pig and the python moving through, and now they're on the other end.
So in today's economy, Trump's plan seems impossible. Well, without an economic miracle.
Maybe if every single person went out and bought a cheap new car.
Jared Bernstein was an economic advisor for Vice President Joe Biden.
That might get you there, but that means everybody has to buy a car. And by the way, it has to be an American car.
Oh, and Bernstein says we'd all have to buy that new car every year to keep the economy white hot. I do love that new car smell. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's some news of presidential debates today. Who's going to be on the stage and who won't? The Commission on Presidential Debates announced this afternoon that Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and Green Party candidate Joel Stein are not doing well enough in the polls to be included. Very definitely included, however, will be Facebook and Google and a bunch of other social media companies. Facebook and Google in particular are going to crunch the data on users' social media doings and searchings ahead of the debates, data that will then go to the moderators and, in theory, inform the questions they ask and make those questions better. In theory. Here's Mitchell Hartman from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
In an email, Facebook told me this new effort will bring more diverse voices into the political process. Analyst Jack Myers at Media Village agrees.
It's like taking the temperature of the population. And social media will give the moderators a better sense of what's capturing public opinion.
Especially, he says, among younger voters who spend their lives tweeting and Snapchatting and whose opinions are notoriously difficult to survey through traditional polling. There's a less elevating possibility, says Princeton political historian Julian Zelizer.
It can create a much more chaotic and ugly debate because what's out there in the social media is not always pretty. And so some of the questions, some of the issues that come from the public might actually diminish the quality of a debate.
For instance, what are the top trending election searches on Google today? Jimmy Fallon and Trump hair.
Donald, I want to ask you, because the next time I see you, you could be the president of the United States.
And the Tonight Show host's big ask?
Can I mess your hair up?
Carlin Bowman at the American Enterprise Institute says what generates social media traffic is the day's big stories, birtherism, email. But when people are asked through traditional public opinion polls what they want the presidential candidates to address...
The economy, terrorism, and healthcare. Those are the top three issues.
Anyway, as Facebook is quick to point out, the moderators don't have to use any of the social media data to ask questions on debate day. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so raise your hand if this has happened to you. You open your cable bill and you think to yourself, man, that is a whole lot of money, especially because I'm already paying for Netflix and Hulu and whatever else it is that I signed up for. Come on, you've been there, right? Michael O'Connell has been there as well, and he did something about it. He cut the cable cord for the summertime. I should mention here, by the way, that he covers television for The Hollywood Reporter, and so, you know, what could possibly go wrong? Michael, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
You're a television writer, man. How did you, what, how, why unplug from TV?
You know what? I moved out of a roommate situation and I was going to be living by myself. And it just seemed like an unnecessary expense, the way I've sort of been consuming media of late.
Tell me how you did it.
Well, I got by with a little help from my friends.
Well, aggressive password sharing was the phrase in the article.
Yes, and my parents, actually. Even though I am a 33-year-old man, I have been leaning on my parents' cable password a little bit.
Which they haven't changed since 1998, I read.
Which they haven't. It's a small pool of passwords in the O'Connell family. No, it was surprisingly easy. I already had a shared Netflix account that I pay for with some friends who use it, but then someone has a Hulu account that I use. But the real issue was the sort of like authentication of cable, which is a big obstacle. So if you don't know anyone who's willing to share, it could be problematic.
Give me a sense then of what you were watching, what you were consuming. Were you in, like, the national television conversation, you know?
Yes. There were only a few moments where I felt, like, a little behind on the, like, water cooler conversation with shows like Mr. Robot or Unreal, like, two really, like, hot cable shows from last summer that people got a little feisty about this year. I was also just watching something just circumstantially because I couldn't just flip through the channels.
Right.
I didn't know that PBS had such a robust app. And you
go public broadcasting.
Go public broadcasting. You don't have to enter a password or anything. And I was watching the Great British Bake Off,
which is now sadly in
some
trouble.
Oh my god! That's a whole other conversation. Jeez.
The thing that struck me though about this piece is that you spent so much time watching on your phone.
It's not something that I recommend.
Yeah.
I was really busy this summer. I just moved. Like, I didn't set up the internet right away. So I couldn't even stream on my actual television set. I needed to watch on my phone. So it sort of lessens the experience, especially with some of the, like, richer cinematography-focused shows. Like, I watched a lot of The Night Of on my phone, which was really dumb. Mm. And then with, like, reality shows and news, it's a perfectly fine way to consume content.
Yeah. Although watching on your phone, right, and you talk about this in the piece, you couldn't do the second screen thing. You couldn't tweet. You couldn't check your email. You had no idea what was going on out there while you were watching TV.
Watching the Republican and Democratic national conventions on my phone while
Basically, it was
kind of a social experiment.
Right.
But yeah, I couldn't communicate with anyone, and I was getting all these texts about stuff, and I couldn't respond because then I would lose the feed.
What have we come to? So here we are, end of summer. The experiment, I gather, is over. Where are we on
the experiment? Is over. I'm not getting cable for the foreseeable future.
But you have internet and you have an actual TV.
I have the internet now. I was going to get an Apple TV, which I said in the piece, but the overwhelming reader response, and I'm not endorsing one product or another, but the overwhelming reader response was that I should get a Roku.
Oh, that's so interesting. I've heard the same thing.
Yeah.
But
I haven't gotten my act together yet, so I still don't have it.
Michael O'Connell, senior reporter at The Hollywood Reporter. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
Looking at them in a bar, you would have no idea. They're just normal guys.
Not when you get to know them. Not at all. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 88 points on this Friday, 0.5%, 18,123. The NASDAQ gave back 5 points, about 0.1%, 5244. The S&P 500 down 8 points, a loss of 0.3%, 21.39. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow squeezed out a gain of 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 2.3%. The S&P 500 up about 0.5%. The Justice Department is asking Deutsche Bank to pay $14 billion American dollars to settle a probe into mortgage-backed securities during the financial crisis. Deutsche Bank says not a chance. Nonetheless, shares fell 9.3%. The New York Attorney General is investigating why Exxon hasn't written down its assets 2 years after oil prices began their long decline. Exxon down 1.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. These are, as we have been reporting for a while now, not good times for the coal industry. It's been an issue on the campaign trail. It's been an issue for coal companies. Several really big ones have filed for bankruptcy protection. And next week, it's going to be an issue in Congress. The deal is that as those coal companies are getting reorganized under Chapter 11 of the bankruptcy code, they're also getting out from under their employee retirement and health care obligations. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
Some 10,000 retired coal miners demonstrated at the Capitol this month, asking Congress to pick up a tab their companies left behind. Wayne Thompson of Western Kentucky retired from the largest coal company in the world, Peabody Energy, which will stop issuing retiree and health care benefit checks in January. Thompson complains that the law lets Peabody do this.
And get away with everything that they owe their people that they've promised them for years. These people that you see here built Peabody Coal Company.
Here's what happened. 5 years ago, coal prices peaked, and many mining companies made billion-dollar acquisitions, and a lot of that money was borrowed. And then coal crashed. World demand fell, markets went soft, and prices plummeted. Patrick McGinley teaches law at West Virginia University.
So when the coal market went south, the coal prices went down, these companies couldn't service their debt. So the companies that loaned the money, investment bankers, hedge funds, they're first in line.
In his view, top coal executives took huge financial risk and they didn't learn their history. Looking back, he says thousands of companies have gone bankrupt in this volatile sector. It's boom bust.
They basically sunk their companies and the collateral damage was miners and miners' widows, pension fund, and health care benefits.
Bankruptcy law basically allows this. Here's how. When a company is intact, it enters into a collective bargaining deal with workers. It takes on obligations. Columbia law professor Ed Morrison.
It's very difficult for a company to step away from its obligations to its union outside of bankruptcy. But once it files, it's a completely different situation.
Now, in bankruptcy, everyone who wants a piece of money fights to get in line. And legally, the workers are the junior lenders. They're further back. Standing in front are the banks. Now, the bank's argument is they lent money assuming they would be first in line. Otherwise, they wouldn't lend. And if you push the banks back, they and the economy would suffer.
It means that it's harder to start a business in this country. It's harder to finance a business in this country. So you kind of have to weigh those two things. And it's a very difficult question about what's the optimal balance.
But balance is not what the workers have in mind. Many of them argue that Peabody made a complex move to ditch its worker obligations. Years ago, it formed a second company called Patriot, and it was so financially weak it quickly went into Chapter 11. In other words, it sped up the bankruptcy process. Now, Peabody doesn't acknowledge this, but already another big coal company is going the same route. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Internet review sites, like Yelp, is probably the best-known one. They can help you find a great new restaurant nearby, or if you own that restaurant, they can help with marketing the thing. Not everything online, though, is as benign as finding a place for dinner, as we all well know. Law enforcement agencies across the country are starting to take notice of what are called John boards, sites where men rate and review prostitutes. Sasha Aslanian from APM Reports has this story of a bust in Seattle, and as you can imagine, this might not be a story for the kids.
What's going on? Good.
Luke Hillman's a wiry guy in his early 40s. He's having drinks in a bar in suburban Seattle with a group of men he first met on the internet.
Looking at them in a bar, you would have no idea. They're just normal guys.
normal guys who worked for some of the region's most prominent employers, Microsoft, Boeing, Amazon. One was a radiologist, another was a dentist. What they didn't know was that Hillman, the man they'd invited into their elite circle, was actually an undercover detective.
I remember sitting there the first time, and I was just like looking around, praying that nobody would see me sitting with these guys and would hear what they were saying.
She has naturally no breasts.
The men were discussing their hobby, buying sex from Korean prostitutes in luxury apartments nearby. The men met on thereviewboard.net. It's one of many sites across the country where men rate prostitutes. Investigators estimate the Review Board had between 15 and 20,000 members. I can't read most of their reviews on the radio. They describe a woman's weight, race, breast size, which sex act she was willing to perform, and her hourly rate. The men in the restaurant were part of a subgroup that called itself the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Police documents show they were spending $300 per session, multiple times a week. They wrote glowing reviews to draw customers to their favorite women. That kept the women in town longer and encouraged so-called agencies to send new women their way.
So they were really operating as pimps.
Valiant Ritchie, a senior deputy prosecuting attorney for King County, is one of the lead attorneys on the case.
They're not charged with promoting prostitution because they went and bought a lot of sex. They're charged with promoting prostitution because they expanded the market. They facilitated visits to these women. They connected new buyers to the women and helped with the screening process. They wrote reviews about them.
After 6 months of undercover surveillance, Seattle authorities seized the league's website and the larger website, the Review Board.
We've just taken down one small tentacle of what's going on. There are still umpteen websites out there that we haven't gotten to yet.
King County Sheriff John Urquhart announced the takedown. 8 brothels were busted. 12 Korean women were offered human trafficking victim services and released. Instead of charging the 16 league members with buying sex, a misdemeanor, they were charged with promoting prostitution, a felony. More than half have pleaded guilty. At his sentencing, one of the men, Paul Reinhardt, expressed remorse and said he'd been drawn into friendships and lost perspective.
I took on a misguided feeling. This was a community like other legitimate communities.
This board is now gone, but it's left a digital trail that could help law enforcement come to a better understanding of how frequent buyers operate. About 15% of American men buy sex at some point, but one researcher found 5% of them account for nearly half the illegal sex buying transactions. Alex Trouteau runs an anti-trafficking nonprofit in Atlanta called Youth Spark. He says in order for high-frequency buyers to feed their habit, they constantly need to find new sources of sex and avoid the cops. That means they have to share intel.
John boards are by far and away the fastest and easiest place to find these individuals.
Prosecutors say the Seattle case opened up a new window into the sex trade, where internet crowdsourcing allows buyers to work together to blur the lines between supply and demand. I'm Sasha Islanian for Marketplace.
Sasha's story was produced for us with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. This final note on the way out today, the Trump event this morning at his new hotel in Washington. Yes, there was the birther thing, whatever that was. Yes, there were all the veterans on stage offering their endorsements, but come on, we know what it really was, right?
Opulence, luxury, gold. This is the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C.
Nice hotel. We have put in tremendous amounts of work and energy and money.
All of this luxury.
Under budget and ahead of schedule. Isn't that nice?
Terrific. Tremendous. Have you seen our $27 tater tots?
Welcome.
Bienvenue.
Namaste.
Bienvenido.
Ahlan wa sahlan.
I said this will be the best hotel in Washington. I think it may be one of the great hotels anywhere in the world. That's the way it turned out.
Mr. Trump, if you're listening, you can go ahead and use that if you like. Also, standing invite is still there. Come on the program anytime. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 88 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ gave back 5 points. That's a tenth percent. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.3% to the downside. Up for the week, though. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Cesar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back here on Monday. Let's be safe out there, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.